This is The Guardian.
A quick warning before we get started. In this episode, there is a brief mention of suicide. We'll put some support services that you can turn to at the end of the episode, but until then, please listen with care.
I'm Jane Lee.
And I'm Matilda Bosley.
And today we're wondering who screwed millennials out of a stable job.
Jane, almost a third of working Australians are in insecure work.
Yep, they're either casuals or freelancers or on short-term contracts.
They don't know what they'll be doing for work in a year's time, which can make it hard to plan and save for the future.
It's a really precarious way to live. But Matilda, what do you think you'd do if you lost your job overnight without any warning?
Well, I mean, probably this podcast episode would be cut a bit short.
So my flatmate wakes me up and says, John Howard's just sacked all the wharfies and they've locked them out. And it was such a shock.
Well, there was one day when 1,400 dock workers,
also known as wharfies,
were sacked all around Australia in April 1998.
Good morning. A tense standoff has developed in the national wharfies dispute, with workers and management refusing to compromise.
Well, I might go back to the beginning. I was 25, I think, at the time of the maritime dispute.
ACTU Secretary Sally McManus, who was a union organiser at the time, was there from the start.
I went into work and immediately the whole of our office walked out and we all marched down to the dock at Sydney, and that was the start of months of organising the picket.
Pickets popped up all over the country, and Sally was a member of the When Shit Hits the Fan committee, which was in charge of a phone tree.
That's what we did before mass texting, right? First, I would get the call from the picket, then I would ring three people, and then they would call five people, and the next people would call five people, and the next people would call five people, in order to get as many people as possible to the picket line.
And at 5 a.m. one morning, the aforementioned excrement did indeed hit the fan at Port Botany in Sydney.
When I got there, there was 10 people on the picket line, 10 people only. If the trucks came and the police came, it would be all over in Sydney. And if that happened, we could lose the whole of the dispute.
But people started to trickle down to the waterfront.
Maybe there was 50 people, then there was 100 people. All of a sudden, people just started coming from everywhere.
As many as 1,000 stacked wharfies and supporters blocked the entrance, despite a court injunction overnight ordering picketers to let traffic cross the line.
And it went from 100 people to 1,000 people very quickly.
It was a human barricade several hundred deep across the road, frustrating the passage of trucks into the Port Botany terminal.
And the police thought, well, they better move in now.
The standoff instantly turned into conflict as 70 officers moved on the crowd.
They started pulling people away and putting people into paddy wagons. It was like mayhem, like total mayhem.
They grabbed men, women and children by the arms and legs, dragging them off the road and carting them over the gutters onto the median strip.
This went on for probably about 3 hours of skirmishing.
One man hung on so tightly, his body was caught in a tug of war.
And in the end, they couldn't break the picket line.
I think part of the reason we were so interested in talking about the whole waterfront dispute is that, in a way, it's kind of a microcosm of a lot of the battles that are happening in workplaces today.
It's a dramatic example of how far a government is willing to go to lift productivity.
And also how a strong union was able to push really hard to defend workers' rights.
Yeah, but today it's a different story.
Like for me, like I left uni and then I didn't get a 9-to-5 job. I couldn't get one, so then I decided to travel. I now teach Pilates.
I've just been doing lots of different things, from working in hair salons to being a personal assistant for friends.
I work as a, like, in two different jobs. I'm a waiter, I'm a bit of a bartender.
I'm doing student ambassador for the university. I'm also a dental assistant on weekends. So I'm trying my best to find any jobs that I can while studying to help out my parents.
It's a precarious time for young Australians. I mean, working multiple jobs just to get by is becoming increasingly normal.
It is very draining, and then you get depressed sometimes, and the anxiety hits you most of the time.
So dark. So dark.
Wages are not keeping up with the cost of living, and fewer workers are even in a position to push back on their working conditions to begin with.
So, what happened?
I love anything to do with the sea, being an islander, and that's the job I got.
This is Thomas Mayo.
I'm a Kookagal, Erabumlay, Torres Strait Islander man and Currarig Aboriginal.
Thomas is now the Assistant Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia.
The MUA.
But he got his start on the docks in the mid-90s.
So picture this. A ship comes in that has, say, 30-metre long steel casing. Each piece of casing is several tonnes. We had a container crane that you see in the big ports when the boom is up. Looks like a big giraffe. And you're in a steel hold of a ship. Big heavy lifts, pretty exciting sometimes, just how hairy, you know, it can get, risky. Of course, you're always operating within the limits, but sometimes those limits were pretty close with really heavy cargo. When I was young, I wasn't indoctrinated as a unionist. I just joined because the old fellows were really nice to me, and I thought that what they had said, you know, made sense about sticking together.
If you weren't in a union yourself for whatever reason, you probably knew someone, you probably had someone in your family who was in a union.
Geraldine Feller is a labour historian and research fellow at Macquarie University.
I turned 30 like 3 weeks ago.
Oh,
and I
was happy birthday.
Had such a crisis of like, what have I done? I haven't taken enough drugs. I've spent too much time reading.
And like a millennial after our own heart, she's been obsessed with the waterfront dispute, looking at it closely as part of her postdoctoral research.
So historically in Australia, trade unions have been a really important part of Australian politics. Part of belonging to that union was, it was almost like a family or a community that you're a part of.
That's so different to today. I mean, union density is 12% of adults in the country right now.
Yeah, but back in the mid-90s, it was 37%. So over a third of working Australians were in unions back then. And Geraldine says that the union was deeply embedded in the waterfront, where almost every wharfie was a member of the MUA. And in the 90s, they stayed in those jobs their whole lives.
It was deeply bound to its community, to the working class community that surrounded it. So it was a workforce with strong roots.
Right, so they lived there, worked there, everything.
Drank their home there, was there. Their whole community and world was around the ports. And most people had some kind of regularity in their roster.
Unions had negotiated rules around these rosters, which determined when people worked on the waterfront and for how long.
So shipping lines and shipping schedules are incredibly unpredictable. You'd clock in, say, at the twilight shift, and it depended a little bit sometimes if the ship had even arrived yet to unload. So you might kind of be waiting around for a while.
This made scheduling rosters difficult for employers. Wharfies would often arrive to work for their allotted shift, only to spend much of their time waiting for work and not moving cargo, which their employer, a company known as Patrick's, saw as bad for business.
So it's not as if, this is some attempt by us to make some massive monopoly profit. This is an attempt to get this company to survive financially. That's what we're about.
That's Chris Corrigan, the CEO of Patrick's at the time. He didn't get back to us when we asked him for an interview, but here's what he said back then about the need for workers' rosters to become more flexible.
All we've asked is that people give us some more flexibility in the rostering arrangements in order to absorb a surplus of labour which couldn't otherwise be absorbed.
Since the 80s, governments have tried to modernise Australia's waterfront. In fact, a number of studies criticised Australian ports for moving cargo too slowly, for being unproductive by international standards.
The job is to get those containers moving, and people expect it, our economy demands it, and they ought to stop mucking around.
Corrigan, having exhausted his negotiations with the union to try and save costs, thought, well, the only way to save the business was to sack the existing workforce.
It has to be a solution that advances waterfront reform. If it doesn't, if it winds back the clock, then in my view we can kiss waterfront reform goodbye for good.
And this set the stage for the waterfront dispute.
Patrick's was in serious trouble because the banks had said, no more. You know, us lending you more money, the game is up.
After a failed attempt at training a replacement workforce in Dubai, Corrigan looked to this man to help him get the job done.
I expected that at some point in my career, I was going to come into conflict in a serious way with the Wharfies.
Paul Houlihan was a consultant paid by the National Farmers Federation. He also used to be its industrial director.
I'm not from some wealthy background and silk purses and all the rest of it at all. My father was a dairy farmer on a small farm in Victoria.
Turns out Australian farmers also have a vested interest in the cost and speed of moving cargo on the wharfs.
We export a hell of a lot of food and fibre from this country. Most of our machinery, a lot of our fertiliser, a lot of our chemicals we use all came across the wharves as well. So bear in mind, this wasn't so much about the money, it was about the control that the union had over the way the wharves worked.
Paul says that Australian ports in the 90s were far more expensive and far less productive than major ports overseas, which was costing farmers money.
If Australia is going to continue to be a major agricultural exporter, we've got to sort this mess out.
Both Corrigan and the farmers wanted to break the union's influence on the waterfront.
The problem that the union had created, all these obstacles on annual leave, who could take annual leave, when they could take it, on rostering, who was rostered on Mondays, all these sort of things, it was all controlled through the union. And that gave them enormous control, which created a tremendous cost on the movement of each container. And that was the essence of what we were trying to disrupt.
So the farmers paid Paul Houlihan to help Patrick's with its plan, to sack the wharfies and train up a local replacement workforce from rural Australia, which can do the job for cheaper.
And they find an important ally in the government of the day.
My government will promote the export industries of this country. My government will defend the legitimate rights of the Australian business community to ensure that the wharves of Australia have world's best practice instead of, in some areas, world's worst practice.
So Howard came to power in 96 and he promised to tighten laws on industrial action.
I have never disguised my desire to see a more competitive waterfront.
For Howard, the waterfront dispute is an opportunity to deliver a blow to the MUA, the strongest union in Australia at this time.
The unions themselves insist on a bargaining monopoly. They want one voice to speak for all dock workers all around Australia. And what my government has tried to do is to break the monopoly of the union. We're not trying to break unions. We don't oppose unionism. We don't oppose unionists. We have no.
Sally McManus says that Howard was following a strategy crafted by past conservative world leaders.
John Howard wanted to have his Margaret Thatcher moment,
which seems to be becoming a bit of a theme.
In the 80s, Margaret Thatcher took on the miners' union And also, Ronald Reagan took on the air traffic controllers. Those were seen to be the strongest unions in those countries, and both of those leaders won. If you could break the strongest union, then you'd be able to, like, scare everyone else and break everyone else.
Howard introduced laws to erode the union's power by lowering the risk workers could fight back.
The legal framework for industrial relations has changed forever under this government. It has changed forever against the tyranny of union thugs.
To put it really bluntly, to move power further into the hands of employers.
The whole thing that allowed our plan to happen, really, is the legislation that the Howard government passed in 1996.
He introduced the Workplace Relations Act.
This significantly weakens union members' right to strike and bans them from striking in support of other workplaces.
That changed the game.
Paul Houlihan was one of the people appointed by the Howard government to oversee the drafting of this new law,
which created a new kind of employment agreement that allowed employers and workers to negotiate working conditions outside the previously set minimums. This encouraged deals to be struck without unions, which in turn helped reduce union membership.
And Paul says it also allowed Patrick's to make deals with its new workers without being bound by the minimum pay rates and roster conditions that the union fought for.
The waterfront is the gateway for this country, and there's no question whatsoever that productivity levels on the Australian waterfront are way below any reasonable international benchmark.
Patrick's also had the help of Workplace Relations Minister Peter Reith.
And of course we have the people and the equipment to have an efficient waterfront and a productive one, but we're a long way short of that mark, and it's not reliable as well.
Peter Reith was John Howard's right-hand man in all things to do with trade unions and employee relations.
I have publicly said on numerous occasions, more than I can count, that the monopoly position of the MUA is definitely part of the problem.
And you see nothing wrong with urging a private company to sack a workforce.
Well, we encourage...
He starts talking a lot about wharfies, how lazy they are, how they're bludgers.
You know, bashing us and always trying to demonise us.
All of this is trying to paint a picture, set a stage in which Howard and Reith can then take on the MUA and they thought at the time win public opinion.
The minister approves a taxpayer-funded redundancy scheme with $250 million just set aside for payouts, you know, in case a bunch of wharfies just happen to get fired.
So when the MUA seriously suspects that Patrick's wants to sack the wharfies and takes it to court to try to prevent that, the company is all ready to put its plan into motion.
On April 7th, 1998, the day before the federal court is scheduled to hear the union's case, Patrick's declares itself insolvent, restructuring its business so that
the company is able to sack its entire workforce overnight.
It was at 11 o'clock last night that Workplace Relations Minister Peter Reith took a call from Patrick's telling him the mass sackings were underway. 11 o'clock, precisely the time that a press release went out announcing the government's response.
Yeah, I know. I put it out at 11 o'clock.
Pretty slick operation.
Yeah, well, I mean, look.
Private security guards with dogs head to the ports.
In Sydney, wharfies found chains on the gates. The company had locked them out.
Scaling cranes and thrusting people out of cabins and assaulting people along with dangerous dogs.
And 1,400 MUA workers are dismissed.
We had a lot of just average citizens, children, families coming and joining us, people that had never been part of a picket line before joining on those picket lines around the country.
How many do you think it'll take to drag you off?
I hope it takes a bloody lot.
I would say I will move, but it will take four constables to move me, one for each arm, one for each leg.
And I hated the prospect of firing all these people. But, you know, honestly, it was something that had to be done. But there was no joy in it. There was no satisfaction. Because, again, as I say, I had a great deal of respect for this union.
Patrick sends buses carrying the replacement workforce into the docks past the picket every day.
Get them into work and then turn around and bring them back out, you know, at the end of the shift. And those buses were being destroyed at about the rate of one every two or three days. They were just being torn apart by the picketers.
How did the workers that you were bringing in feel about that? That sounds really, really scary.
It does. Well, we were paying them, and most of these blokes hadn't seen that sort of money ever. So they were pretty excited about the dough.
Meanwhile, the union is still fighting Patrick's actions in the courts and trying to get the wharfies reinstated.
So far, the picketers have managed to sidestep the law and various court injunctions, leaving containers to pile up on wharves owned by Patrick Stevedore.
It was a massive roller coaster of maybe we're going to lose. Were we prepared to put your body on the line sometimes? Were you prepared to do what it took to win? Sometimes it looked like we wouldn't win.
Until finally...
Welcome to what is certain to be an historic day in Australian industrial relations.
As we know, Australia's highest court has the final say.
The decision by the High Court is that the court has ruled in favour of the Maritime Union of Australia and has awarded costs.
The High Court rules that Patrick's illegally terminated the wharfies, and it orders them to return to negotiate a new work agreement a month after they were locked out.
That has just been announced to the crowd here, and of course got a very positive and a happy reaction from about 1,000 people gathered here. Of course, it's a decision they were expecting. I think they weren't expecting it quite so soon or quite so emphatically.
And so, as we're seeing from our reporting, everyone involved in the waterfront dispute now claims some 25 years later that they won. So, who would you say got the better end of the deal?
It's so hard. So I think it was a political victory for the MUA.
Well, the MUA is here to stay. That was the main chant on the picket line, MUA, here to stay. The aim of John Howard was to destroy the MUA. They're here and they're here.
But under the deal, almost half of the workers have to quit their jobs and take redundancy packages.
So 600 people lost their jobs, which is a lot of people. The stress was profound. A handful of people took their own lives through that period.
And the workers left behind are forced to make huge changes to the way they work. It becomes more casual and less secure.
The work was deregulated and the roster system was deregulated. You know, some ability to plan their lives, that really diminished after 98. People would be called onto shift with like much less than a day's notice often. So you can imagine that kind of unpredictability of, am I working tonight? Am I not? Am I working on Saturday? Am I not? Like all the time, the grinding effect that has on people. And that was something that really hurt workers on the wharves.
The young men Paul Houlihan brought to the docks from rural Australia also lost their jobs.
They were a great bunch of fellas. And in the end, they missed out. We were holding out the prospect of them having long-term jobs on the waterfront. And it didn't come to pass.
As for Patrick's?
Chris Corrigan got a lot of what he wanted. And in fact, the share prices for Patrick's skyrocketed after the dispute.
Patrick's went from a position where the banks wouldn't lend it any money to 6 months later being sold for $650 million. It didn't matter to us who claimed victory. What mattered to us was that the changes were made, you know, and the changes were made.
Like, there's a reason those share prices went up, is that deregulating the roster meant a lot more profits for Patrick Stevedores. But, yeah, the price was high for workers. Something that I've kind of has surprised me a little bit in my work is that I kind of started looking at the dispute in 98 and assuming that what we'd see is a really big spike in casualisation after that dispute. I was completely wrong. It's not the case.
It was already happening regardless of what happened on the wharves. So before this, there was a move from regular permanent jobs to more insecure jobs.
The rise of insecure work actually starts with Labor, the Hawke government back in the 1980s.
Hawke said, restrain, you're asking for too much money, basically. Stop asking for so much money. Stop going on strike all the time.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Jane Lee here. If you're enjoying Who Screwed Millennials, you might want to check out another podcast from Guardian Australia. It's called Full Story. It's our award-winning daily news pod where we speak with Guardian Australia reporters, editors and experts, going beyond the headlines to bring you the latest on everything from politics and environment to economics and health. Follow Full Story wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you there.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Well, Australia's in a pretty sorry state, I've got to say, at this time. The recession of 82, 83 was the worst since the Great Depression at that point.
Greg Jericho, chief economist at the Australia Institute and Guardian columnist, says that in the 80s, the economy was volatile.
High inflation, lots of booms and busts. It was not in any way what you'd call a modern economy.
The Hawke government wanted to stabilise these rapidly increasing prices and wages, as well as lifting productivity.
And if we can get those all under control, then the economy will grow in a steady way rather than boom and bust.
At that time, Australian wages were highly centralised, which means that minimum rates and pay rises were negotiated between unions and governments and set by a commission.
This system contributed to these high wages at the time.
Theme song of the trade union movement is Solidarity Forever.
Ironically, Bob Hawke, who was head of the ACTU during the 1970s.
And I'm going to sing the verses and you are going to bellow out the chorus.
You could say was as responsible as anyone for that increase in wages because he was very powerful and very able to negotiate strong wage growth.
So Hawke does a deal with the unions. He tells them,
we'll restrain prices if you stop asking for such high wages. And in return, we'll give you Medicare, we'll increase the social wage. So it's kind of this deal done.
We can bring in things like superannuation, which will balance out the fact that you've got a, yes, you've got a real wage cut, but you've got free healthcare now.
I think about it, like if you said to anyone now, would you take a 1% less pay rise from Medicare? Yeah, absolutely.
And they agreed. So the first of seven agreements in the Prices and Income Accord was struck in 1983. Decades of economic growth followed the accord, and it also helped shape the working conditions we see today.
We certainly are a richer nation, but work is a lot different. You are a lot less likely to have a job for life, which again is perhaps not necessarily a bad thing. It is good that people are able to transition from one industry to another or one employer to another and not feel like you're beholden to your work forever. In terms of security, though, at work, you are a bit more on your own. but many more women are working in many more sectors, many more occupations, and the pay gap, while it still exists, is much closer than it ever has been. It was a thing of its time. It was an attempt to address forces in the economy that needed to be addressed, and it's probably something that you look back on in hindsight and think, yeah, there were mistakes made.
The accord also introduced enterprise bargaining, which significantly limited workers' ability to strike.
My personal view is that I think we would be much better if we had have stuck with a system that perhaps wasn't as centralised but allowed multi-employer bargaining across industries.
The number of working days lost to strike action plummeted after the accord. It means that the practice, the muscle memory of what it means to actually struggle against, you know, a dodgy employer, to build that solidarity and that kind of experience with your colleagues, you lose that and you lose power.
But I certainly know, you know, union and labour people at the time were not thinking, oh, this is going to be how we'll bring down unionism. And certainly conservatives at the time didn't think that was going to happen. They kind of hated the accord. They thought it was giving unions all the power.
The kind of height of neoliberalism in the 80s and 90s impressed a view on society that was, you know, fairly dominant, that, yeah, unions were like this old school thing that didn't matter anymore and were irrelevant.
But Australia pretty much took off again, and we saw asset prices and company profits booming up again. And so, yes, it might have helped produce some societal benefits, but I think really when you look at it, you can see that it marked the start of a kind of trickle-down economics, where it really began the now 40-year stretch, really, of companies doing well, workers not doing so well.
And you can draw a straight line from this point in Australia's history to today, where wages have been falling backwards in real terms for over a decade.
All the while, company profits have been growing. In fact, since March 2016, total profits have gone up 157% compared to wages, which have grown only 35% in that time.
The wages share of GDP is near a recent record low, and of course that means the profit share has been growing. And that is the result of, you know, decades-long trends of moving away from centralised wage fixing when everyone gets a wage rise at the same time.
Paul Karp is Guardian Australia's chief political correspondent.
And before, I was a reporter at Workforce. So I was writing about unions, so I've sort of nibbled at it from both sides of the baguette.
As union membership fell across Australia, it became harder and harder to get a pay rise.
The best way to get a pay rise in Australia is actually to change job, and Treasury has said this themselves. More and more workers are left to bargain one-on-one against their boss rather than to have a union to do that for them and to have the threat of collectively withdrawing their labour by going on strike. And as a result, people get paid a lot less.
But back in the 80s, Hawke and Keating's plan to modernise the economy was aimed at raising the standard of living in Australia, getting people into higher paid jobs.
They wanted to move Australia's economy from relying on manufacturing things like cars and clothing to one that's more about providing professional services, you know, office jobs.
Well, I think the push really just came as a consequence of what was happening around the world, a real sort of shift towards globalism. But I think also there was a recognition that parts of Australia's economy were a little bit backwards.
Up until this point in time, Australian manufacturing and other industries were protected from the global economy, not part of it.
Taxes on imports, known as tariffs, were high, making it more expensive to import stuff made overseas, like cars, clothes, electronics, than to buy locally made products.
So in the 90s, in order to move away from manufacturing and make consumer goods cheaper, they decide to lower those tariffs.
They wanted to, in a sense, lower prices, but also make the Australian domestic producers more competitive. In effect, realise, wait, we've got to compete with these guys now on a bit more of a level playing field.
The governments at the time said, well, this is about pushing for global trade rules. That means there's an even playing field, without acknowledging the massive power of multinational companies and brands whose interest solely was in making more profit at whatever cost.
Today, Michelle O'Neill is the president of the ACTU, but early in her career, she was a union rep for a significant group of workers within the manufacturing industry, textiles, clothing and footwear.
Like the manufacturing sector across the board in Australia at the time, the textile, clothing and footwear industry was one of the highly unionised sectors of the economy.
A once massive industry that was dominated by migrant women.
That industry follows migration patterns. People who'd come to Australia from a range of different countries, from Italy and Turkey and Greece and Vietnam and China.
So when tariffs were lowered, decimating the manufacturing industry, these women were the ones it hit the hardest.
So the first real shock of the lowering of the tariffs was the textile industry. Massive loss of jobs.
It was a belief in a neoliberal sort of economic theory that somehow it'll all even out, that, you know, you kill off one industry here and another one will grow here and the market will sort it out and people will lose jobs here and pick up jobs there and somehow it'll all be even and okay.
You know, this whole movement in the 80s about modernising the Australian economy, it kind of reminds me a bit of mining and coal jobs today. Because, like, it's widely accepted that Australia and the world in general needs to transition to renewable energy. It just has to happen. But in doing that, there are some people who are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, but the question is, how well can the government support that workforce to transition to other jobs, especially those who are particularly vulnerable, like these women in the manufacturing industry?
It wasn't done in a way that was comprehensive or realistic about where those workers were going to go. And there was too much reliance on, as I said, just this sort of free market notion that another industry would rise and that somehow they'd move from A to B without thinking about the people and their skills and their capacity.
Paul Keating has certainly argued that that was actually a good thing in the long run because those were terrible jobs. And his argument always was, well, they could go out and get a better job, which, you know, is true sort of in the aggregate. Whether it's true individually is another thing.
A third never worked again. A third only worked in jobs that were substandard in terms of not permanent jobs, paid less, more exploitative types of work, and then only a third ever got work that was equivalent or better, which is shocking.
The problem is you're in, say, an industry like textiles, where that can be replicated by workers in low-income countries who are getting paid the stereotypical dollar an hour or dollar a day kind of thing. It doesn't matter how much you improve your productivity, you're never going to be able to compete with them on a level.
And, of course, then we also saw, as well as jobs moving offshore, we saw jobs moving into people's homes. So you saw the deregulation of work here in Australia, and that was when outwork or home-based work really grew.
So while lowering tariffs did open up the Australian economy to higher paid jobs and, you know, made things cheaper overall, it also directly led to higher levels of insecure work in clothing, textiles and footwear.
I did quite a big range of very high-end fashions. I can do anything. I can do woven, stretchy material, and any type of garments I can do.
Nguyet Nguyen left Vietnam after the war and arrived in Australia in 1988 in need of a job.
So people would say, oh, here's the phone number, call this guy or call that lady. So I can get work anytime, anywhere.
She learned from her church friends that she could sew garments for companies from home, allowing her to keep an eye on her children.
My working hours has no limit. So after dropping off kids to school, I go straight to my garage to do my work 7 days a week.
Wow.
This was called outwork, and it could be grueling.
In a very isolated conditions, I'm talking about both physically and emotionally.
1975 was considered the fall of Saigon, and when a lot of Vietnamese refugees started to leave the country.
Emma Doe interviewed a number of Vietnamese Australian outworkers for her book Working From Home.
So Vietnamese women really dominated outwork throughout the late 70s, 80s, early 90s. And it kind of suited their lifestyle, you know, early on. You know, they just arrived in a new country. They didn't have many English skills.
She says they were an invisible workforce within the garment industry.
There was still a fair bit of clothing being made here, and it was usually more complicated clothes. In the mid-90s, outwork was really the backbone of the Australian manufacturing industry. It employed, at any time, up to 329,000 people.
Instead of being paid a regular salary, outworkers were paid by the piece. So for Nuet, there was huge pressure to finish as many garments as she could in order to make more money.
Even my daughters, they never noticed that I was sleeping. So when they go to bed, they kiss goodbye, and then I was still on the machine. And then in the morning when they wake up, of course I have to wake up early, prepare their things for school, but then quickly back to my work.
No annual leave, no sick leave, no weekends.
1 hour to go to church on Sunday, that's it. And no go out, no holidays. Emotionally, I was really bad. Sometimes I talk to my husband like, I think I'm a slave here in Australia. When you watch TV or movie about, you know, slavery, something like that, I'm not better than them. I'm working and have no life.
And for 20 years, no pay rises.
Sadly, the price in those 20 years never increased. So if I get paid $6 for one top, then it stays there until 20 years later.
Brands began chasing bigger profit margins for themselves. And it was not really a bargaining process because the brand had all the power. They could just say, well, if you don't take it for this price, we'll simply go overseas.
I could send this work offshore and get it done cheaply in another country in Asia, or I could send it into somebody's garage in Springvale and I could get it done really cheaply then.
So while brands' profits were rising, these migrant women's wages were going backwards.
And the insecurity that meant in terms of people's homes, whether they could keep their home, pay their mortgage or pay their rent.
And because outworkers often didn't speak English fluently and were less likely to be in a union than garment workers in the factories, they didn't have a lot of bargaining power to push back on these conditions.
If I'm late or if I'm doing anything wrong, if I couldn't fix it in time, they would charge me for the retail price. Instead of paying me $6.50 for one garment, I have to pay $200.
When she made mistakes, Nguyet had to pay the retail price of the garments she sewed.
$200 instead of the $6.50 she was making per item.
And she remembers taking her kids window shopping and seeing one of the garments she'd made on display.
And they said, oh, Mum, we made this one. How much did you get this one? And I said, yeah, $6.30.
Nguyet got paid $6.30 for that garment. But when she flipped over the price tag...
$249.
Wow.
Yeah.
Her kids were stunned.
And they said, oh, why? Why so cheap?
Michelle O'Neill says the experience of outworkers like Nuet has now been replicated across other industries in Australia and all over the world.
what I saw in the textile clothing and footwear industry has been adopted by companies and sectors and industries all over Australia and the world. So it's like the textile clothing and footwear industry was the sort of vanguard for this creation of insecure work and also of distancing our workers from the employer. We want to distance ourselves from the people that are doing the work, so it's someone else's problem. And if something goes wrong, they were creating long, complex supply chains so they could go, oh, it's not me. And I think it's a deliberate move by employers to try and reduce labour costs and to not take seriously their responsibility for the people who are actually doing the work and delivering the wealth for their companies.
So, was it worth it?
It's always horrible right in the instance, but if you are a government thinking, okay, this is what we want for the next generation of workers, the kids of these people who are working in these factories, wouldn't it be better to get them into other industries?
Nuet is now an outreach officer for the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union, but before that, she did 20 years of insecure work to support her children.
I just think of my children mainly.
Would you ever encourage them to go into outwork or work in the clothing industry?
No, definitely not, because it's really precarious, really. If you're lucky, you get a minimum wage, but you're better off not doing the sewing. But I mean, I have a lot of other opportunities. They've got their own skills, so they can do anything else.
But young people in the workforce today are increasingly finding that they can't do anything. While they may have access to better jobs, their wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living or housing prices.
Yeah, of course, it is much harder than for us, because everything compared to the wage and the house price are really, really high. My husband and I also thought about this is hard for them.
It makes you wonder how different gig work really is from the insecure work of our parents' generation.
It reminds me so much of outworkers, like they never necessarily meet the person who's really giving them the work or in control of their work. They're told that they're not employees, that they're contractors, that they have to be responsible for all their own safety and workers' comp and super. And then they have no control, you know, they're basically made to deliver in really tight timelines.
There's quite a lot of debate about whether or not, you know, it is really a new business model at all, because like unions say, oh, well, piecework always existed, but it's suddenly more in the ascendancy because of apps that allow you to aggregate all those jobs in one place and to make a living off it, although with great difficulty at times.
Everybody says they want more flexibility, but what does that all mean? Flexibility is working a 40-hour week or a 4-hour week, if that's what you need.
Airbnb it and get paid for that extra room.
Delivering with Uber lets you make money on your own schedule.
When gig platforms like Uber entered the market in the 2000s, they sold insecure work as flexible and empowering.
85% of drivers say they need flexibility.
That allowed workers to determine their own hours.
Connect with freelancers who have been vetted for quality and experience.
Because flexibility works.
A lot of people use the gig economy to supplement their income rather than as their sole source of income. And on the one hand, that's great for flexibility. But on the other hand, if there weren't a lot of people needing to supplement their income by doing this work, maybe there would be a few more secure jobs rather than lots of bitsier add-ons to jobs. Or if people were had more secure employment to begin with, like if they were working the number of hours they wanted, maybe they wouldn't feel the need to turn to that alternative source of supplementing their income.
People try and dress this up. Employers try and describe this as being, oh, it's all about flexibility, when, of course, it's one-way flexibility.
For over a decade, gig platforms were allowed to pay their staff below minimum wage because they weren't seen as employees and instead were classed as independent contractors.
The Albanese government has only recently introduced minimum standards for gig workers with its closing loopholes law.
So it's things like the minimum wage, and it's also things like minimum standards around deplatforming, which is the 21st century equivalent of unfair dismissal on the platforms. You know, an employee can't be sacked without reason. They have the benefit of unfair dismissal laws. And soon the Fair Work Commission will be asked, well, what are the minimums involved in when a platform can boot you off and say, well, you know, it's good that you spent $50,000 on your car and signed up to be an Uber driver, but you're not an Uber driver anymore. We're booting you off the platform. So those are the sorts of things that we're expecting to see minimum conditions on. Uber has agreed to that in theory with the Transport Workers Union. But what this will do is it will spread those minimum conditions across the whole gig economy.
And in order to improve those minimum conditions, we're all going to have to start paying more for these services.
And this has been referred to as the end of the millennial lifestyle subsidy, which is basically that the prices of gig economy services have been kept artificially low by two things. One, the gig economy's business model is to lose money because they take a whole bunch of venture capital money and they burn through it in customer acquisition, offering cheap prices to get people to use the platform. And of course, the other thing they do is that they squeeze the workers by trying to pay less. And so those two things have propped up the extremely low prices that people love about the platforms. But at the end of the day, neither of those are really sustainable.
So, just to recap, Hawke and Keating opened up the economy, but in doing so made it harder to strike, which led to lower union density and a decline in wages, which filtered through to the Howard era when more laws were introduced to give even more powers to employers.
Correct. But there's one more piece of this puzzle, and it gets placed by Howard a few years after the waterfront dispute.
On the 9th of October 2004... the Australian people re-elected the government, conferring on it the honour of and responsibility for managing Australia's affairs.
Howard gets re-elected for a fourth term, now with more seats than before.
A win over Mark Latham in that election gave John Howard a majority in the Senate. And that basically meant they didn't have to deal with a crossbench that might object to elements of their program.
This gives the coalition even more power to push back against the unions.
And they could implement a pure capital L liberal workplace relations policy. And one of those was to reduce unfair dismissal rights for employees.
In 2005, Howard introduces work choices into law, changing workers' rights in two significant ways.
First, he
changes the unfair dismissal laws to make it much easier for businesses to sack their workers.
So that's actually quite a large section of the Australian economy and quite large businesses, medium-sized large businesses that didn't have to deal with that anymore.
Second,
it accelerated this trend of using Australian workplace agreements to give up minimum conditions that are contained in awards.
Make no mistake, our mining industry is driving our economy. Flexible workplace arrangements are critical to driving productivity and prosperity. Over 50% of Australian miners are now on workplace agreements.
The boss and I talked about what works best for us both. With a young family, I wanted flexibility. But if we're made to tear up our agreement, we both lose. And there's nothing right or fair about that.
Let's keep workplace.
So they tried to sell it as a necessary change to increase the flexibility of the labour market, that it would cut out the middleman, which is, you know, these nefarious unions, and would mean that people could bargain for better contracts that suited their lives. And it was basically another bite of the cherry, another attempt to transform Australian industrial relations.
And look, it might shock you to hear this, but the result is giving more powers to employers over their employees.
That would have really, really damaged the union movement.
But the unions weren't going down without a fight.
I get $11 an hour, no penalty rates, no public holiday rates, and no protection from unfair dismissal.
These were extremely unpopular policies at the time. The unions launched the Your Rights at Work campaign.
These are meant to be prosperous times. So why has my grandson got less rights at work than I had?
That saw kind of mass mobilisations and demonstrations in opposition to the work choices reforms.
The IR laws are taking away important rights and have set us on the path to United States-style inequality and disadvantage. And that is what we are fighting against.
This was also an epic battle, and it was like working people in Australia standing up against the tide of neoliberalism.
John Howard is not prepared to repeal the laws, so we must elect a government that will.
It managed to just mobilise hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, I was very young at the time, but even I remember, and I was like 14, filling up Olympic Stadium with union members opposing the reforms.
Let's give it everything we've got, because if we do that, we will win. Thank you.
John Howard had experienced a decrease in popularity and was behind in the polls, so it was one of the major factors of Howard's defeat in 2007.
I therefore accept full responsibility for the Coalition's defeat in this election campaign.
In 2007, Howard not only loses the election, he loses his own seat, ending his political career.
Today, Australia has looked to the future. Today, the Australian people have decided that we as a nation will move forward.
The Rudd Labor government sets about dismantling work choices, but there are key parts of this policy that remain in the system even today.
So there's still very significant restrictions on the right to strike in Australia. In fact, Australia has one of the most restricted rights to strike in the world.
Trade unions argued that they were still always negotiating with one arm tied behind their back because it was so hard to take a strike in Australia. And that continued the trend of lower pay than they otherwise would have been able to win.
And young people today are far more likely to stay in insecure jobs that, like gig work, is more likely to be done at home on a laptop rather than in a factory or on the waterfront with other people.
They have more tenuous relationships to their workplaces. They might move through multiple jobs, like I'm sure we all have and do. And that makes it harder, though not impossible, for people to be organised. So I think it's a little bit more, like it's a real chicken and egg situation though, right? Like you have the restrictive laws, which make it harder to take collective action, which means that less people join their unions, which makes it harder to take collective action.
Right.
And also in turn harder to challenge those laws.
So this feels like somewhat of a mess, Jane.
Hmm.
I guess my question is, at the end of the day, who screwed millennials out of secure work? Was it Labor or the Coalition, the unions, business in general?
I mean, the answer is all of them.
Some responsibility for this lies with the leadership of our unions. These laws should have been challenged. The union movement is in a death spiral from these laws, and there's not enough of a discussion, I don't think, about the right to strike.
Recent industrial relations changes have given some power back to employees. So Labor have made changes like multi-employer bargaining.
They've also supported a rise in the minimum wage and a recent 23% pay rise for aged care workers. And the latest wage price index shows that wage growth outstripped inflation for the first time in 3 years.
So those are the levers the government is pulling, and the results so far are very positive.
And Paul says the pay rise for aged care workers could flow on to other sectors, helping workers in disability care and social services push for a similar raise.
But the employers still have a pretty strong hand because they've got decades and decades of running down the rate of union density in many workplaces. What we have now is a series of hurdles to taking industrial action and very low union density. So it will take more people joining unions and it will take more people withdrawing their labour through industrial action to get top dollar or even medium dollar.
Geraldine, you're a millennial, right?
Yeah.
So I'm also a millennial. And this series is about, I guess, the economic conditions we find ourselves in today, for millennials and Gen Z. What would you say all of these historical moments in industrial policy in Australia have, what have they all led to for millennials and Gen Z today?
Well, like a lot of insecurity, you know. I guess to talk from, I don't know, from my own perspective, like I'm 30, I've never had a permanent job. I haven't seen a single permanent job in my sector for my discipline in my city advertised this year. And I'm like very lucky, like I have got a contract. I work with great people. I've got, you know, relatively good wages thanks to the strength of my union. But yeah, like the reality I think is pretty dire for people of our generation and younger. So yeah, it's led to a real, like that deregulation of the labour market for us is hurting pretty badly.
I'm wondering what your personal perspective is on whether you think the conditions you've just described for our generation, have they been inevitable?
No. No, I don't think anything's inevitable. I think we kind of have to imagine that the world might be able to be different.
To do that, tune in to the fifth and final episode of Who Screwed Millennials? This episode was presented by me, Matilda Bosley.
And me, Jane Lee. I also reported it with Michelle Macklem, who produced and mixed this episode.
Sound design was by Joe Koning, and the series producer is Miles Herbert.
Our executive producer is Miles Martignoni, and commissioning editor is Gabrielle Jackson.
Additional production by Mel Chun. And thank you to Jamie McMeachin from the Maritime Union of Australia for providing us with archival material for this episode.
And if this episode has affected you in any way, support is available on Lifeline at 13 11 14.